Welcome to today's deep dive. We are really thrilled you could join us today because the material we have on the table is just intensely fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. It's a heavy one, but an important one.
Exactly. Our mission today is to unpack a highly charged, heavily debated editorial extracted from a source PDF we've been reviewing. It's titled The New War on Dissent: Sedition, Silence, and the Assault on Democracy.
Quite the title.
Right. And we are going to, you know, deconstruct the core arguments, the historical framing, and the very specific warnings laid out in this text.
And visually, the document sets this uncompromising tone before you even read the first paragraph.
Oh, the borders, yeah.
Yeah, the text is bordered by these really vivid, dynamic images of a waving American flag spanning the top and bottom margins.
Which is a very deliberate choice.
Completely. That design choice immediately establishes a framework that is urgent and undeniably focused on foundational American ideals. It visually signals to the reader that the stakes being discussed here are existential for the country.
Yeah, that framing implies we aren't just talking about abstract policy disagreements.
Oh, right.
The text really positions this as a battle for the constitutional soul of the nation.
Right.
But before we really get into the mechanics of this argument, I want to make something incredibly clear to you, the listener.
Yes, this is a crucial point.
This source material contains strong, politically charged arguments about the current state of American politics.
Yeah.
We are not taking sides today.
Absolutely not.
We are not endorsing any of the viewpoints presented in this document, nor are we dismissing them. Our job is strictly to act as your guides.
We're just here to impartially unpack the claims.
Right. Impartially unpacking the historical references and the logic laid out here so you can fully understand the contours of this intense conversation.
And that neutrality is vital, especially given the weight of these claims. I mean, at a high level, this document operates as a massive rallying cry defending the First Amendment.
That's really the core of it.
It is. Yeah. The central thesis is that a modern culture of intimidation has taken root, one specifically engineered to chill free speech.
And it outlines how historical laws and modern regulatory threats are supposedly being weaponized, right?
Exactly. Weaponized to silence critics, pressure the media, and ultimately frighten ordinary citizens into compliance.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the text doesn't just start with a list of modern grievances. It actually anchors its entire worldview in a very specific, somewhat infamous piece of American history.
The 18th century, yeah.
Yeah, the opening section focuses heavily on the Sedition Act of 1798. Let's look at the constitutional mechanics the text is pulling from that era, because the argument relies heavily on the fact that this law has been dead for over two centuries.
The Sedition Act of 1798 is a fascinating anchor point. For context, that was early legislation making it a crime to publish false, scandalous, and malicious writing against the government.
Which sounds crazy to us now.
It does. And what the text emphasizes is not just that the act expired in 1801, but that it was never actually ruled on by the Supreme Court.
Never tested at the highest level.
Right. The rhetorical question posed here is why a law so seemingly powerful was allowed to just fade away.
And the document provides an answer to that.
It does. The answer provided is that even early American leaders understood a law criminalizing political dissent was fundamentally incompatible with the Constitution they had literally just written.
Right. Modern First Amendment doctrine makes it totally clear that you couldn't pass a law like that today. But the core grievance laid out here isn't about passing a new law.
No, it's about the spirit of the old one.
Exactly. The argument is that the spirit of the Sedition Act is being resurrected. The text claims that invoking the ghost of this dead law, or using the concept of sedition to threaten political opponents, comedians, journalists, or members of Congress, is a completely baseless and profoundly unconstitutional tactic.
What's fascinating here is how that historical concept is transformed into a very sharp critique of modern governance.
Yeah, they get very specific.
They do. The document explicitly calls out a specific, though unnamed, government official who is noted as having sworn to uphold the Constitution twice.
Sworn to uphold the Constitution twice. That's a very pointed description.
Very pointed. The accusation is that this official is threatening critics with a concept that was widely condemned even back in the 18th century.
The rhetoric used to describe that behavior is striking. Calling it a betrayal of the oath of office elevates the critique from a simple disagreement over policy to an accusation of constitutional sabotage.
And the analytical lens applied here suggests that reviving sedition rhetoric isn't about actually enforcing the law, because the law doesn't exist anymore. It's a psychological tactic. By throwing around terms like sedition or treason for basic political opposition, the goal is to chill speech through fear.
And just scare people into silence.
Exactly. It creates a chilling effect where people self-censor because they don't want the headache or the potential legal nightmare of being targeted by the state.
And that psychological tactic doesn't just apply to politicians or pundits. This is where the document shifts gears.
A major shift, yeah.
The text takes this concept of chilling speech and applies it directly to the military, moving from historical legal ghosts to very present-day institutional conflicts.
It's a highly sensitive area to touch on.
It is. There's a whole section detailing what it calls the danger of false sedition accusations, specifically regarding how service members are being treated.
The military component is arguably the most complex part of the argument. Within military structure, the distinction between a legal order and an illegal order is absolute.
You can't blur those lines.
You really can't. The text firmly argues that warning the military about illegal orders, or discussing the nature of those orders, is not an act of sedition.
Which is what some might try to label it as.
Right. But in fact, the document highlights a foundational principle of military justice: service members are legally required to disobey illegal orders.
That concept is critical to understand. Disobedience in the face of an illegal order isn't just an option or moral choice. It is a binding legal requirement.
Precisely.
The text is making the case that reminding service members of this requirement isn't an act of rebellion or subversion.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this kind of speech reminding the military of their duty to refuse unconstitutional commands is framed as a fundamental civic responsibility.
Civic responsibility.
Yeah.
Not a crime.
Exactly. The logic here is that attempting to label this civic responsibility as criminal sedition essentially turns the entire constitutional order on its head.
It's an inversion of reality. The text argues that the people stepping up to protect the constitutional framework are the ones being labeled as threats to it.
Often by the very individuals who are actually undermining those institutions.
Right. You have this dynamic where loyalty to the Constitution is being conflated with disloyalty to a specific leader or administration.
That inversion is the bedrock of why the text claims the First Amendment is under unprecedented threat. The definitions of loyalty, duty, and sedition are allegedly being intentionally warped.
When the meaning of those words becomes malleable,
they can be used to serve a culture of intimidation rather than the rule of law.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the text makes a massive pivot. It moves away from the chain of command and 18th century legislation and drops the argument right into our living rooms.
The media section.
Yes. We get a section titled "A Free Press Threatened by Intimidation," and suddenly we're looking at specific pop culture figures.
It definitely grounds the theory in something tangible.
Late night hosts Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel are explicitly named in the text, alongside broader entities like major newspapers and television networks.
Bringing in figures like Colbert and Kimmel grounds the abstract constitutional theory in everyday media consumption. The argument is that these high-profile comedians and the networks that broadcast them are facing active, deliberate intimidation from government sources.
And the mechanism of that intimidation is what really stands out to me. The text doesn't claim these figures are being thrown in jail.
No, it's much more subtle than that.
Instead, it cites veiled threats of politically motivated mergers or regulatory retaliation.
That's the key phrase.
It's a modern, heavily corporate form of silencing dissent.
The phrasing there, regulatory retaliation, is incredibly dense. We are talking about the weaponization of bureaucracy.
How does that look in practice?
Well, imagine a massive television network is trying to execute a routine corporate merger. The implication here is that if a comedian on that network's late-night roster is too critical of the government, that merger might suddenly be blocked by antitrust regulators.
Stalled out of nowhere.
Exactly. Or the network might face sudden, unexplained hurdles from the FCC.
It transforms the sprawling federal bureaucracy into a cudgel. You don't need a sedition act if you can just threaten a parent company's stock price or stall their business operations indefinitely.
It's highly effective.
The underlying message being sent to the press, as distilled by the text, is chillingly simple. Speak out and you may be punished.
That brings the argument full circle back to the founders' intent for the First Amendment. The text posits that this specific kind of veiled bureaucratic threat is exactly the abuse the First Amendment was designed to prevent.
Because it wasn't just about polite conversation.
No, the protection of free speech wasn't enshrined to protect polite agreement. It was built to guarantee that the press could relentlessly criticize power without the fear that power would retaliate and destroy their livelihoods.
So we have the philosophical grounding, the institutional warnings regarding the military, and the corporate threats against the media.
All very high-level structural issues.
Right. But the text doesn't leave the argument hovering at the institutional level. It brings the consequences directly to you, the ordinary citizen.
This is where it gets very real.
The final major section of the essay is titled, A Climate of Fear for Ordinary Citizens. And this is where the theoretical debate becomes highly personal.
This raises an important question. One, the text forces the reader to confront. What happens to the fabric of a democracy when the average person simply feels afraid to speak?
It's a scary thought.
The document observes a cultural shift, claiming that citizens currently feel that questioning government actions puts a target on their back.
The imagery of having a target on your back speaks to a profound breakdown in civic trust. It suggests an environment where participating in basic democratic disagreement feels like inviting surveillance or personal ruin.
The text takes a step back to analyze that specific fear. It argues that when citizens feel targeted for dissent, the flaw doesn't lie with the citizens being overly paranoid.
It's not just in their heads.
No, rather that pervasive fear is the ultimate proof that a culture of intimidation exists. It indicates a shift where those in power view public dissent not as a guaranteed constitutional right, but as a hostile threat that must be neutralized.
There is a remarkably meta moment in this section, too. The author writes, I write this editorial with the full understanding that people raising valid legal or constitutional concerns may fear retaliation.
It's a very self-aware moment in the text.
The text openly acknowledges that just by reading, sharing, or agreeing with this very document, people might feel nervous.
It operates as a self-proving thesis. If a reader feels a sense of trepidation about publicly endorsing the document's defense of the First Amendment, the text would argue that that exact trepidation validates every warning it contains.
The fear itself becomes the evidence.
Yes, the fear itself becomes the evidence of the assault on democracy.
But the document doesn't just diagnose this fear and leave you feeling paralyzed. It makes a sharp pivot into a practical survival guide.
It gets very tactical.
It offers highly specific, actionable advice under a section boldly titled, Protect Your Rights. It moves from diagnosing the problem to equipping the reader.
The advice is really grounded in civil liberties defense. It outlines three distinct steps for anyone feeling targeted. First, document everything, keep a meticulous record of any intimidation or threats.
Always a good first step.
Second, share those concerns with trusted individuals so you aren't isolated. Third, and most crucially, contact appropriate authorities and establish civil rights organizations if you feel your rights are being infringed upon.
The tone shifts to one of reassurance here, clearly stating that the right to speak freely is protected by law, regardless of who is attempting the intimidation.
It's trying to build psychological resilience.
Exactly. But then the document concludes with an extraordinarily specific, localized call to action. We go from sweeping discussions of 1798 to a list of Washington, D.C. office numbers.
The specificity of that final section is a brilliant rhetorical device. The text targets the states of Nebraska and Iowa, providing a meticulous list of contact information for specific elected representatives.
It's very direct.
It urges readers in those states to pick up the phone and demand support for First Amendment rights.
Let's look at the exact targets of this call to action, because it highlights how tactical the text becomes. For Nebraska, it lists Senators Deb Fischer and Pete Ricketts alongside Congressman Don Bacon, Mike Flood, and Adrian Smith.
And for Iowa?
For Iowa, the targets are Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst and Congressman Zach Nunn and Randy Feenstra. The document provides their D.C. office addresses, their direct phone numbers, and their websites.
By ending with that granular detail, the text forces the reader out of a passive state of philosophical agreement and into active democratic participation.
You can't just read it and do nothing.
Right. It takes all the high-minded theory about sedition, military duty, and constitutional guarantees and funnels it into the most basic mechanism of civic life, calling your representative. It demands that the reader use the system to protect the system.
So what does this all mean? When we look at the totality of this deep dive, from the visual of the waving flags at the beginning to the list of Midwestern phone numbers at the end, what is the overarching thesis we can extract?
It boils down to one clear message.
The text spells it out in its closing thoughts. Democracy requires citizens who refuse to bow to fear.
That is the ultimate distillation of the argument. The First Amendment is presented not as a passive shield, but as an active requirement.
The cornerstone.
Exactly. The text refers to it as the cornerstone of the American promise. The underlying warning is that if this cornerstone is chipped away, whether by the resurrection of dead laws, regulatory threats against comedians, or a generalized culture of fear, the entire democratic structure loses its integrity.
Whether you find yourself agreeing with the political framing of this text, or whether you question the validity of the specific examples regarding the media and the military, engaging with these impassioned arguments is crucial.
It absolutely is.
Examining this document helps you understand the intense, high-stakes debates happening right now regarding the boundaries of free speech, the limits of executive power, and the role of the media. These aren't just academic exercises. These are the active fault lines of modern civic life.
As we conclude our analysis of this material, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building on the dynamic we've just explored.
Something to take away.
The source material focuses intensely on the threat of top-down, government-driven retaliation, the idea of powerful officials using laws and corporate regulations to silence dissent.
Right, the traditional view of censorship.
But looking forward to the realities of our hyper-connected modern era, we have to consider a different mechanism of silence. How might the sheer volume of information, digital noise, and algorithm-driven echo chambers act as their own form of silencing dissent, entirely without the threat of an expired sedition act?
That's a huge shift in perspective.
If controversial or dissenting voices are simply algorithmically buried beneath a mountain of curated content, is dissent being effectively suppressed not by government fear, but by sheer algorithmic apathy?
Completely different but equally powerful type of chilling effect. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material today. We love having the opportunity to navigate these complex, challenging topics with you. Keep questioning, keep analyzing, and keep learning. We will catch you on the next deep dive.